Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Xiaoqiao Ling, who's Associate Professor of Chinese at Arizona State University, and she'll be talking about her new book, Feeling the Past in 17th Century China, which was published last year, 2019, by Harvard University Asia Center. For anyone living through a historical cataclysm of some kind, it can be easy to forget that enduring the trauma of feeling like the world is ending or changing irrevocably has been a fact of life pretty often throughout human history. It seems likely that part of that forgetting is a result of the difficulty of fully empathizing with the feelings others have felt, a leap made all the more difficult when comparing oneself to others who are temporally, culturally, and linguistically removed. For this reason, among many others, Xiaoqiao Ling's Feeling the Past in 17th Century China is an invaluable act of transporting us as readers into a new sensory world, namely that of the Chinese literati who experienced the transition from the Ming to the Qing, a dynastic change brought about by the Manchu conquest of the Han world and its inclusion within a wider empire of which it was just a single part. Exploring writing in numerous genres, from theatrical works to plays, memoirs and erotic novels, Ling teases out a level of subjective feeling and embodied intimacy which is really striking to see in the works of figures who, one might assume, took themselves somewhat seriously as men of letters. Furnished with rich extracts in the original classical Chinese, or Wenyan Wen, this book is also a formidable work of literary translation, and in weaving together primary sources and analysis, it paints a vivid picture of men wrestling with commitments to community, family, and perhaps most poignantly to themselves as they negotiate the new order that has enveloped them. So whatever one's inclination towards comparison, it's hard not to see parallels here with other ages and other places which, for better or worse, have been rocked by political and social upheaval. But the author is here in our own age of upheaval of a kind to tell us more about all of this. And so I'll say, Xiaoqiao Ling, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for appearing. Before we dive into the book and its sort of tumultuous events and the reflections on them by these literati figures, though, maybe I'll give you a chance to say something a little bit about your background and how you became interested in the subjects in this book, and indeed any other subjects that you're interested in.
Oh, sure. I'm from China. I finished my BA in Renmin University, and I came to the U.S. for my graduate studies. I first studied at University of Washington for an MA degree. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Harvard to do a PhD. So both my MA and PhDs are in the same field, East Asian Studies, which is a really small field in U.S., by the way. I developed this interest of late imperial China just basically because this is an unruly age. And so it's full of vitality and a lot of things going on. I did my dissertation on one of the key figures in this book, which is Ding Yaokang. And so I kind of, the book sort of spun around that central figure, and I dabbed in more into other figures from this period, other writings. And so, yeah, the book is a result of that. So it was a ongoing course of exploration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Ding Yaokang definitely comes through as a very vivid figure throughout the book too, and we'll get into him and his pretty intriguing biography in a bit, I think. But I just wonder as well, from a linguistic point of view, I guess for people like myself and others who study modern and contemporary China, obviously something that jumps out in a book set in this period is the use of classical Chinese. And it's actually something I've never been fully sure of myself, but how much exposure to classical Chinese did your education in China give you in terms of, or was it something you had to learn extensively as a student later?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because Of course, secondary education in China is also changing right now. But when I entered college, and in fact finished college because I majored in English in college, I didn't receive any education in classical Chinese other than having to rote memorize some of the key essays. There was no explanation of the syntax of how the grammar worked differently. We were just asked to memorize certain key essays to pass the exam. I would say all my education in classical Chinese, especially across the linguistic barrier, because the working language is English, so we need to also translate the classical Chinese into English. And so that would force us to look at the language. So it's almost like a different language compared to modern Mandarin, because the syntax, the grammar, everything is just really different. Part of my graduate training is really to learn how to translate and also how to read this classical Chinese.
I think that's interesting to hear. Is your impression then, you say that things are changing now, is your impression that more education in the classical language is now being included in education in mainland China?
I think that definitely there's more emphasis now. It's considered like the cultural legacy, right? The literary past. There are all sorts of like competitions, mass media to promote the classical Chinese and also the really enormous literary corpus from traditional China. And so that was something that wasn't there. It wasn't something that was like a hot topic when I was growing up. But like cultural literacy, legacy is a big topic, and that the notion that you need to be committed to this literary legacy as a citizen, that's also something that's recently emphasized. Recently over the past decade, something like that. I'm not familiar with the actual curriculum right now, but I think there should be like more in terms of content-wise, probably a little bit more emphasis. But I don't know if, because this is another thing as a native speaker, you weren't really taught like how to dissect a different language because you assume it's still your language. And so therefore, I don't know if the teaching method itself will change dramatically. But I definitely think the content-wise, there should definitely be more about classical Chinese in the curriculum.
I see. I mean, I think it's probably quite unfair of me to even ask you that, especially so near the beginning of our conversation, because that's not really the topic of the book. And all I'm doing is exposing my own ignorance of such matters. So I think we should move on to actually talking about the kind of content and incredible amount of rich work that has gone into this book. So now we know something about its origins. Perhaps we'll jump into the introduction, in which you kind of lay out the structure and the kind of different themes that you talk about before continuing on to five chapters and an epilogue. So you've given us a little clue there as to your attraction to this very lively and incident-filled late imperial period and why you're interested in it. So could you give us a bit more sense of what that period was, specifically, I guess, the 17th century on which this book focuses? What was going on?
Oh, 17th century. Well, in China, what was going on was really the Manchu conquest of China, which was, of course, not the first time when a non-Han Chinese regime conquered China, but it was the first time when the conqueror deliberately implemented policies on forcing the Han Chinese subjects to adopt the Manchu way of dressing, and of having their hair, while the male subjects having to shave their hair. So the Manchu conquest of China has this kind of really embodied aspect of it. And so that's very particular in 17th century China. But also globally, 17th century, this is just such a connected age. It was the age of silver, the early modern time. So there was a lot of parallel across the globe at that time in the sense of the rise of this mercantile class and this rise of individualism. This urge to redefine the sense of self, and a lot of like intellectual vigor going on. So 17th century across the board was an exciting time.
Well, and that excitement in the Chinese context does emerge in great detail from the book. But what were then some of the kind of responses to this upheaval and the turmoil of the Manchu conquest that literati figures came up with? I mean, what was the reaction, as you say, to being under a new regime and in many cases being forced to adopt quite bodily modes of subordination, maybe, to that regime?
Right. Since we're talking about the literati, and like you said, they take themselves very seriously because men of letters, literati, it's not just a tag that point at their own sense of intellect, but in traditional China overall, being a literatus or being a man of letters really means like you carry on this moral mission. As this person who have to safeguard this this civilization, this entire heritage, and so there is a lot of moral responsibility in that. And so when we talk about the literati's response to the Manchu conquest, of course there are different modes of responses in terms of actual political choices. You can easily divide people into two groups, those who collaborated with the Manchus or who complied with the Manchu regime and those who refused to do so. And so that is traditionally a very valid and sound like political label to show like who is loyalist, who is not, who is fine with switching allegiance to cooperate with a new regime. But that is the political choice or the existential choice, but there are also like literary choices. And so that's where things become a lot not like black and white. And so that's also where different literary choices, and by that, we also mean the choices of different genres and different ways of writing because writing was really this way of communicating with the world and also to monitor your sense of self. And so in terms of the literary choices, there were just a lot. It's really rich. And also writing was a way of forging a sense of community. And so writing was also a way of reaching out to readers. And so therefore, the literary choices was also a socially and morally significant choice because you define your sense of self in the community. And by defining that community, you identify yourself as part of the social body.
Right. And you do trace some of the connections and some of the, I guess, intertextual dimensions to different authors that you discuss in the book, and how they were reading each other and yes, I guess actually, you know, performing this community, as you say. The writers that you focus on primarily, including Ding Yaokang and others, come generally from the Jiangnan area. Now that's the kind of, I guess, broadly south of the Yangtze area, if I'm not mistaken.
The lower Yangtze Delta, most.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's the significance of that area in the history of the Manchu conquest, and how did the fact that they came from this particular place shape their experience of that event?
Yeah, it's a really significant place. It was basically this hub of cultural center because the Manchu conquest itself as an experience, it has widely regionally different perspectives. And so in the north, the Manchu conquerors actually met a lot less resistance compared to the south. So because the south was kind of nested, it's south of the Yangtze River, which is incredibly hard to cross, right? If we think about 17th century, right? Mm. And so therefore, the south was always like well nested and also well connected. And it was also a really rich area. When we talk about the civil service examination nationwide, the south or the Jiangnan area was also the place where competition was the fiercest, which meant there were a lot more talented men of letters from this area. And so that's why there is this really distinctive regional sense of identity as the talented person who represents the heart of Chinese civilization. This is why when the Manchus crossed the river, they ran into some of the bloodiest clashes in the south. And so to a certain degree, that decision to implement the hair-shaving policy was really targeted at the southern elite as a really direct way to humiliate them. Right. And so therefore, so the south, the Jiangnan area, it really underwent like this really dramatic clash. And so therefore, that sense of loss, that sense of humiliation is really poignant among the literati figures. And also the literati network or the communities, we saw some of the most pronounced communities from the Jiangnan area. So we kind of saw like little social hubs and cultural hubs typically centering around like a garden or a really beautiful, like a local resident, like a literary salon, something like that. And so that's why the Jiangnan area was really important as a figure of remembrance.
Oh, that's really interesting. And you also mentioned, I guess, some consequences of the fact that there was a lot of emphasis placed on subjugating this area by the conquerors in that, I think, one of the kind of bloodiest, most violent, I guess, acts of conquest was in Yangzhou and some of these other areas actually maybe put up the stiffest resistance to these outsiders coming in. So that's really interesting to hear. And I guess also interesting from the point of view of locating where people perceive the center of Chinese civilization, if you know, that's too vague a term, to be, right? Because actually that's pretty far east from the, you know, in the kind of grand canvas of where China, you know, quote unquote, originates from. As you say, there's a very concentrated sense of cultural kind of intensity there.
This also had to do with the printing boom, the book culture at that time. So 17th century, it was also this time of commercial publishing. And so a lot more writers saw their own writings published during their lifetime. And so there were, of course, several centers of major book productions, but the most beautiful, the most elaborate, deluxe editions, they were from the south. And so basically, if you think about like really exquisite editions of books, you think about a few cities specifically, they were all in the Jiangnan area. And so real like center of cultural production.
Right. And yeah, I guess again, that adds to that sense of concentrated, interlocked and more intense cultural space.
Right.
And, that kind of leads us on, I guess, to this question of the body, which I guess throughout the book does have multiple meanings, because you're talking about the kind of subjective experience of these individual literati figures, but also, as you've already mentioned, the social body and a kind of extended sense of community there. So could you say a bit more about your sort of understanding of the body, both as a kind of affective, receptor for new experience, but also as a community? Could you sort of elaborate a bit on how you understand this idea of the body?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. So I approach the body to go beyond the dichotomy of the body and mind, because the body within the Confucian sense is really not only the seat of emotions and perceptions, but also the seat of moral being. And so the body is really this moral, the embodiment of a moral person. So therefore I use the body as a way, as a medium to process the experience of the conquest. And so I do treat the body individually from the perspective of emotions and sensory perceptions. And so that is more on the individual level, the body as affective receptors for experience. But I also treat the body as a trope, as a literary figure. And so that is where the body becomes something larger, becomes an active factor in the building of the social body. And so that's why I chose the genres that are like really embodied genres, in the sense that the genre itself foreground the notion of the body. For example, an erotic novel, right? And so it centers around this lustful body, right? The body as a seat of sin that needs redemption. And whereas the deliverance play, it also foregrounds the body as like it's a kind of religious experience. So the entire play drives towards this eventual deliverance, to deliver this sensory body from its entanglement, emotional and sensory entanglement, and also from this mundane world in general. And so when we talk about the body as a trope, then we're talking about the body as this language, as this token that you can talk about, that brings in all of these implications on ways to deal with your past, the ways to redefine your sense of self. And so to that end, the body becomes something larger than the individual sense of body.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And often those, I guess, experiences mapped onto both subjective persons' bodies and wider social bodies are related to or held up against memories and senses of longer term continuity. So could you say how these kind of immediate affective responses to what's going on relate to questions of remembrance and I guess a perspective on what has gone past? I mean, the past is in the title of the book.
Well, it has to do with the sense of embrace or rejection, right? Or this will of wanting to forget and the impossibility of forgetting. And so, yeah, using the notion of the body, we really get a sense of engaging with the past by making choices and very convoluted choices of rejecting it, embracing it. And of course, it's never like clear cut, black and white. And so all these are different modes of engagement. So you could denounce your past, but you still keep a part of it as part of the stigma of yourself. And so instead of completely purging it, you keep a part of it and using that as a ground on which to rebuild yourself. And so the body, it really becomes like this platform where you can negotiate different terms of dealing with your sense of the past. And of course, the notion of the past also keeps changing depending on how you want to engage with the past. That's where the emotions themselves, when you record them down, they become this very powerful tool of self-monitoring as well. So this is why I included like these memoirs and diaries, because they show to us like how the way the past is engaged emotionally is also a way of the current subject to decipher the past, or to choose a way of engaging with the past effectively.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. And yeah, it's a particularly strong, I guess, juxtaposition of genre that comes through when you're laying these memoirs and diaries alongside some of the more, I guess, fictionalizing embodied works like theatrical and erotic novels and so on. Yeah, yeah. But just finally, before we do jump into the kind of content chapters themselves, I just wondered actually about returning again briefly to language, because feelings and a sort of sensory subjectivity are somewhat kind of context specific and vary, you know, between languages and cultures as they exist at the same time. I mean, I guess personally, something I found about learning other languages is finding a way of expressing feelings that seem rooted in a certain kind of context, you know, in another language. I don't know if that's only me, but it wouldn't surprise me if it's a more general experience that it doesn't always seem like there are direct translations for feeling type terms. So I just wonder, when you were translating, obviously from a different language, as you've already kind of explained in terms of your experience with classical Chinese, but also from so long ago, what were there difficulties that you faced in knowing how to translate these literati figures' expressions of their feelings or of the feelings of others into English in particular?
Oh, yeah, that's actually part and parcel of our graduate training here, which is when you translate, it's all classical Chinese, but classical Chinese itself also ran a spectrum of different registers. And so when you translate emotional self-representations, the very fact that where those emotives are located also should shape the way you decide to translate, because poetry, essays or prose essays, as opposed to plays and fictions, they all treat emotions differently. And so that's why choosing different genres to write is almost like a kind of social contract. So the writer, they, by choosing a specific genre, they are already kind of defining the community of readers or the way he wants to be read. And so to that extent, the choice of the genre itself is already like this cognitive definition of how you want to approach the emotions. And so therefore, the challenge of translating is really like to pit it and to grapple it within the context of that particular genre. And so if you're dealing with a really beautiful, like high registered poem, then you really cannot use the kind of earthy language that vernacular fiction usually would be using. And so I think, yeah, tapping into the different registers of language in English to kind of bring out the nuance in the way emotions are encapsulated in different kinds of literary experiences, that was part of the challenge.
I can imagine, yeah. And I think it sort of creates an even greater sense of awe at the diverse range of translations and quite extensive extracts you have in the book from lots of different sources, into which we will now, I think, dive a little closer. So in chapter one, you deal with a genre known as the deliverance play. And I guess specifically, you're talking about Ding Yao Kang here, among others. So could you say something about, what a deliverance play is as a particular form, but then a bit more on Ding Yao Kang and his life and career, both sort of literary biography and also just more general. What did he get up to and experience during his lifetime?
Oh yeah, right. A deliverance play is a very particular subgenre of traditional Chinese plays. Historically, it was associated with this particular form of theater that thrived during the Mongol Empire. But when it reached the time to Ding Yao Kang's time, which is 17th century, as opposed to the Mongol Empire in the 14th and 15th century, this form of which the deliverance play was a subgenre was already really purely there for reading. And so it is part of the part of reading experience, of course, has to do with envisioning the staging of it, but it's still part of the performance is still part of the reading experience. And so that's why the Deliverance play in 17th century as the subgenre of a theatrical form that was very much part of a reading experience became like really this accommodating genre for you to play with the convention, to push the boundary of the convention. And so therefore, it became a really good vessel for the author to experiment with something. And so here, this particular Deliverance play became a way, well, a Deliverance play itself, it's about deliverance, right? And so, but deliverance in a religious sense, usually in a Taoist religious sense, which is really about casting aside all your bodily attachment to this world, including your desire, your wish to become famous, your wish to become successful. So all those worldly attachments, the Deliverance play is engaged with cutting off all these ties, worldly ties towards the end, often with the help of a religious figure who would conjure up all kinds of ruses to have the protagonist pass as a kind of trial. A lot of times they don't even pass it, but eventually the Deliverance play always delivers them. And so that kind of the format of this becomes a way for Ding Yao Kang to put his own personal experience into this. So it's a religious play, but then he replaces these religious ruses by really contemplating on ways of engaging with the past, like whether you want to forget it or whether you trying to forget actually is futile. And so it becomes this way for him to experiment with how he wants to process the Manchu conquest as it was ongoing at the time. So it's very much part of like figuring out how to engage with the world. And so he used the Deliverance play as a literary form to explore his own personal concerns. About Ding Yao Kang himself, he's a very prolific writer. He never really passed the civil service examination, and so he never became an important scholar official. And so to that end, he was sort of like a more like common kind of or a typical kind of literary man in the sense that he wasn't one of those important cultural figures, but he was very much part of that social network or the cultural network among which a lot of the very prominent literary figures were part of. And he also traveled a lot. He is actually himself from the north, but like this book shows, he became really involved in these literary networks in the Jiangnan area. And so that very fact that he's a northerner who traveled to the south and who engaged actively in these literary circles in the south and also in the north gives him a kind of the sense of national import. So he is a person of the north and of the sentiments of the south. What makes this Deliverance play really relevant is also the fact that how he engages a community of his immediate friends as imagined readers or audience of this play. And so therefore, he is really like staging this act of reading as this communal experience. And so therefore, as a writer, he just becomes this really important epitome of the sentiments of that time, but also someone who actively engages himself in this community building kind of endeavor.
Right. And the play, I think you discuss is called Songs and Tunes on Transformative Ramblings. Wonderfully evocative translated title, but there's all kinds of different ramblings that go on throughout the book. I think it's itself a very interesting and evocative idea. Thanks. That's a great kind of, potted history of Ding's pretty interesting, I guess, straddling of two worlds, North and South. But as we'll perhaps also discuss shortly, he also kind of has, I guess, another dual capacity in that he spends some time in retreat from the conquest, but also ultimately ends up working in the Qing capital.
Somewhat
in a collaborationist fashion.
Eventually resigned as well. And so he's like going back and forth himself. And we kind of see how his change attitude towards the regime got filtered through his literary output as well.
Right. And and I think some of the latter discussions you have of his some of his other literary works definitely bring that out. But before that, in chapter two, you've already highlighted a bit here the kind of some of the significant dimensions to generic distinctions between things like plays, even ones that are meant only to be read, and then also memoirs and diaries and so on. And so chapter two brings out the work of three writers in particular, although also, again, referencing some others, but Wang Xiuchu, Zhang Maozi, and Ye Shaoyan are the kind of, I guess, protagonists of this chapter. So could you say something about how their memoirs and these works were helpful in helping us see beyond trauma as a kind of prima facie, I guess, response to the conquest?
It's interesting. The fact that Wang Xiuchu and Zhang Maozi, their writing did not actually surface till late 19th century, early 20th century, extremely late, which meant that throughout the Qing dynasty, their testimonies of the Manchu conquest remained hidden. But with the rise of modernity, 20th century, there was like the surging anti-Manchu sentiment again, because the Qing China was really collapsing and caving in to all the kinds of like Western imperialist forces. And so there was that time when intellectuals, they became again, restless, and they attributed all these failure to the ineptitude of the government, and the very fact that the ruler was non-Han Chinese made them an easy target. And so this broadly anti-Manchu sentiment accompanied the surfacing of these writings. And so therefore, typically, Wang Xiuchu and Zhang Maozi's writing, they were seen as like these historical sources, as testimonies against Manchu atrocity. And so I grouped them together with Ye Shaoyuan to try to show how writing itself, even when it looks like it's non-mediated, like as if it is just realistic testimonies of what happened, in fact, it was part of the literary choice. And so I kind of group them together to show how the kind of unflinching account of carnage is just as deliberate a literary choice as the kind of lyrical mode of dealing with the everyday in Ye Shaoyuan's case. So basically suffering the bloodiest massacre and trying to save yourself and describing all the turmoil, all the pain that you go through, when you put that down in paper, when you encapsulate that into a kind of moral tale, that very act itself is just as conscious as engaging, writing a diary, recording the everyday experience, writing down the gatherings, the eatings and drinkings, and situating yourself in that kind of mundane activity. So I kind of try to show these two modes of engaging with the contemporary world was both part of the literary choices of writers from this time.
Right. And these were figures primarily who kind of withdrew somewhat, right? I mean, lots of the characters you talk about are people who were sort of whose response to the advancing Manchu conquest and then the subsequent years and even decades in some cases was to sort of run off into the woods and renounce and become monks or kind of responses that were to do with, I guess, basically not accepting the new way of things. But I mean, it's also really fascinating to hear about the life of these texts in the subsequent, centuries and up to the end of the very end of the Qing era. Who were these diaries kind of written for? I mean, who were, what were Wang Xiaochu and Zhang Mazi and so on's work just sort of personal things, or were they intended for an audience of some kind?
Yeah, I guess both. So they were like private acts of writing, but then the way they write it and the way they engage their potential readers and also the way they process themselves, they definitely show anticipated a particular group of community. And that is exactly the kind of community that is the social body that I tackle with in this book. And so it is a personal decision to record these experience, but they appeal, they make an appeal to a much broader, like men of my own kindred spirits. And so by making that gesture, they are already reaching out to forge this sense of community. And so it's both. It's a private act, but it is also a public act of reaching out and forging this sense of community. And so I believe these individual writings, they were kept like within the family. And so they were kept and transmitted through hand copying. And some of them, some versions even circulated as far as Japan. And so, yeah, it definitely had an interesting afterlife throughout the Manchu period. It's just never cogently up in the front in the face of the Manchu conquerors.
Right, sure. Well, in that sense, this book itself brings them into yet another context and kind of puts them in a setting which maybe is closer to what they belonged in than lots of the other ways that they would have been read in ensuing decades. Now, chapters 3 and 4 together kind of bring us back to Ding Yaokang and I guess delve into a kind of fuller appraisal of some of his work in other genres. You've already highlighted or alluded to the sort of fact that he went back and forth and kind of was, on the margins of both, I guess, the world of full-on collaboration or reconciliation with the new government and then also, I guess, flirting with rebellion too. So could you say something a bit more about his broader oeuvre and how it sort of helps us understand these choices between acceptance and rejection of the new way of things under the Qing?
Yeah, this is why Ding Yaokang is such an interesting figure, because if you look at his literary corpus, he very meticulously put his own writings in chronological orders. And so poetry he wrote throughout his lifetime. And so he had several collections of his poetry meticulously chronicled. But in terms of other genres, it's very interesting like which particular genre he chose to engage at different phase of his life. And so the Deliverance play, he only wrote one of that within. It's a particular theatrical form, like I said. He only wrote one of that. And that was also when he was still very much part of the Manchu conquest. He was still running for his own life and not knowing what's going on. And so he's very much like caught in the middle of things. And so he chose the Deliverance plays to delve with all these uncertainties and openness. But later on, when he so for a decade, he was actually serving under the Manchu court. as a instructor. So very not even part of the administration, but a very like marginal low position. But as instructor, then he can also have this sense of moral mission. It's like I am educating the Manchu students. So he was actually like teaching Manchu students about Chinese classics. And so there is this sense of moral sense of I'm spreading the influence of Chinese civilization. And so in that role as an instructor, he produced the bulk of his plays. And these are southern plays. So they are different from the Deliverance play, which was a part of the northern play. And so the southern plays, they are, again, very formulaic. They're almost always like romantic plays, very long, but all often having a historical background against which the romance takes form. And goes through these trials and tribulations until a final grand reunion. So he makes use of this trope or this literary form as a way to express his own attitude towards the Manchu conqueror. So in one of his plays from this period called The Travels of the Red Pine, he actually drew upon this historical parallel to compare the Manchus as saviors of China, because the Ming actually fell not to, technically the Ming didn't fall because of the Manchus. It fell because of peasant rebels. And so there was that really narrow window time when the Manchus were not seen as conquerors of China, but they were avengers of China because they were driving down, they were defeating the peasant rebels. Mm-hmm. And so he made the topic of one of his plays, this historical play, but of course using history as a veiled parallel of his contemporary time. And so, by engaging this, he is really kind of conveying this idea, like how ready he is to embrace this regime by comparing them to avengers of China. But interestingly, after he resigned from his teaching post, that's the point where he wrote this erotic novel. And so in that novel, he really, again, set it in a historical past, but then that historical past sheds a very unflattering light on the Manchus. And so within his own literary corpus, you kind of saw the change of his attitude and the development of his sense of self and how he wants to engage with the contemporary world. So we kind of see in his own literary corpus the richness of these different vacillating points in his ways of situating the self. And so that's what makes him really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess in that latter erotic novel that you mentioned, it's an analogy or an allegory with the Jin Song transition, right. Another kind of period when, people came down from the north and took over the central plains or whatever that he's drawing on there for this quite pointed sort of argument he wants to make about the Manchus. As regards kind of more oppositional writing like that, you discuss the idea that there were literati feeling as though, they were kind of leftover figures from the Ming who were engaging in a kind of activism, those that were more resolutely opposed to the Qing. What kind of form did this activism take? I mean, do you understand that activism just to be writing in a particular way? Or were there sort of any, I don't know if this is even known, but were there sort of any organizational efforts that were made by groups of scholars?
There were a lot of actual resistance forces. And because a lot of these literary figures, they were also local elite. And so they actually, some of them formed their own armies. And so they would like recruit like peasants in the regions or soldiers. Or they even have like their own household army, that sort of thing. So there were real actual resistance And a lot of them actually led by these literary figures. So this is why from this period, when you look at a literary person, they really take on like different kinds of lives. For example, one of the loyalist figures, Qi Biaojia, who was part of the literary circle that Ding Yaokang was part of, he was a martyr. He killed himself as an official. But on the literary landscape, he is best known to be the owner of this beautiful garden and this writing of remembrance, that this nostalgic writing, and also this literary connoisseur of beautiful things, of high culture. And so you really, when you look at the literary life and the political life of these figures, or even like military life of these figures, they are incredibly rich.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think your balancing of those two kind of perspectives, both biographical and literary, is such a valuable aspect of the book as a whole. Finally, kind of moving on into the last chapter, you're dealing with people who, I guess, came up as scholars or writers at a slightly later stage. I mean, once Qing power, I guess, was fairly established. And so these are not people necessarily who actually experienced firsthand the transition. So for writers like Kong Shangren and others that you discuss here, the post-generation, as you put it, how did the kind of sort of temporal situatedness of them and the fact that they were kind of from a slightly different era affect their attitudes towards the past and their writings about that kind of earlier era?
Oh, yeah. So I use this notion of post-memory exactly because we're talking about the same literary community. And so when we actually see in the historical play of Kong Shangren the staging of both generations, so the conquest generation, who are the generation of Kong Shangren's father, that generation, and then the post generation, that is Kong Shangren's own generation. So you kind of see how the tightness of that literary community, but then in terms of the historical situatedness, Kong Shangren could no longer write as if he was in an age of turmoil. He actually had to write about his present as this age of sagely ruler, that was the Manchu ruler. And in fact, in the case of Kong Shangren himself, it's interesting because Kong Shangren himself, he was one of the direct descendants of Confucius himself. And so he's like, I don't remember exactly, but like something like the 63rd generation or something. A direct line that traces all the way back to Confucius. And so this is why the emperor, the Qing emperor, actually paid him homage and really singled him out as this descendant of the sage himself. Mm. And so in that case, he was actually put into a minor kind of administrative position because of this imperial honor or the imperial notice. And then he went ahead and wrote this play where he contemplated the fall of the Ming. And so he couldn't say anything about his own time as bad, right? So he had to put it as like order restored and everything looking up. But when we are dealing with the actual losses and when we are in the time when things seem to have completely healed, but when the ruler is actually one who actively try to purge our remembrance of the past, in that kind of context, how do we still deal with these actually still very immediate and haunting past? And so that's right. What post-memory, the post-generation has to tackle with.
Mm. Yeah, and you kind of include some reflections on other writers or actually these appear in other places in the book too, people who write things that are somehow derogatory about, what is now, I guess, Dongbei, but the Manchu homeland, you know, accusing it of being a sort of wild and barbarous place, or make comments in their writing about Manchus as distinct from Han or Chinese people and those kind of, I guess, the consequences that they then have to bear as the authorities crack down on them. And in the epilogue, I guess you provide quite a few sort of little tantalizing reflections on, I guess, what you've just mentioned there about people writing under particular constraints, ideological constraints. So I wonder, do you feel like your perspective on the role of writing and of memory and you know, the erasure or, I guess, exposition of memory in the past, did this writing experience and the research experience of putting this book together change your kind of sense of the role of politics and the past in writing and the role of the author in kind of bringing things to light?
Oh, yeah, it definitely makes me more aware of the fact that we're all each individual, every one of us. We are to a certain degree active bearer of history. And the very fact that we are like living right now and in an unprecedented time and basically a kind of historical moment kind of foregrounds that sense of the self, right? And so how you engage how do you make sense of the world around you and looking ahead and looking at the past? This is where the past and past, present, and future, I try to put that in a kind of loop. So it's not a linear kind of sense. And so because the way you conceive of the present is always already shaped by the way you conceive of the past. And so the future is also a part of the extension of this conflated sense of the past and present. And so I just think I am more acutely aware of how malleable we all are and how our own perspectives keeps changing. And so to a certain degree, the engagement with the past is an ongoing way of living. And so that's why to be able to remember becomes a morally and politically significant act itself. And so, yeah, I definitely think the way we take of the past or the present may be different in depending on who we think we are and who we identify with, who our education or our central cultural sense of ourselves. They all play a role in how we process our sense of the present and the past. And so to that end, definitely there will be multiple voices, that's definitely to be expected. You cannot see, in fact, anything that we cannot agree on typically point to something that we all forget, right? And so basically to come in agreement points to amnesia itself. And so I kind of welcome that contentious multitude, diversity take of the past and the present, but the very fact that we hear different voices, I think that's important, meaning that things are kept alive.
And it's really wonderful to have that lesson drawn or that kind of perspective taken from a period which in many regards looks, you know, I guess incredibly different from the one that we are currently in. I think as you've sort of alluded to there, has parallels with the contemporary moments that, you know, lots of us are engaged with, whether in China as this book is set in or indeed anywhere else. So thank you so much, Xiaoqiao, for appearing today and giving us all of this fascinating insight. There's an awful lot more in the book that we didn't get to talk about. And I'd encourage, of course, listeners to become readers and pick up a copy. Before we let you go, though, can I just ask you what you're working on at the moment? Has lockdown and the like provided you with new and exciting avenues or put a stall on things? Or Obi, what are your current projects?
Oh, I'm currently working on another play, which is called The Romance of the Western Wing. It's a play that somehow enjoyed unfailing level of popularity since its appearance in the 13th century. Of course, the things that we have at hand, the earliest printed edition of the play came from 15th century. But the very fact that it remained popular going through literally like hundreds of reprints and with all sorts of commentaries, glasses, pictures, and all sorts of like prefatory materials. And so the vitality and also the diversity of social groups that chose to engage with this particular play became itself a kind of unprecedented cultural phenomenon, because basically no other play had enjoyed this sense of continuity and also this plethora of printed editions. So I'm trying to use this play as a focal point to look at the diverse social groups that chose to engage with this play and got something out of the play, and try to figure out like how the kind of social life this play went through sustained its own canonical status. So it's a way of dealing with the different kind of history of reading or the different levels of reading strategies, reading practices, and the social significance of those.
Well, that sounds absolutely fascinating, and I guess a bit like what we've been talking about today, a great way of weaving together a pretty kind of deep, a sense of deep time and history, but actually, yeah, I guess in the life of one work, which, yeah, sounds great. So I'll look forward to checking that out when it appears. In the meantime, Xiaoqiao, thank you again so much for appearing on the show. It was really fantastic to talk to you.
Oh, thank you.
Listeners, thank you too for listening. If you've listened this far to New Books in East Asian Studies, it's a podcast on the New Books Network, and it will be back again with you very soon. Goodbye.